I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Lorna Crozier joins me again. The distinguished poet and author has just published a new collection of poetry, The Wrong Cat. It's a collection of poetry that has been said is vintage Crozier. You have poems about animals and people in this book. They're charming, sexy, irreverent, as are the rich characters she evokes. Whether it's two people talking, asking questions, or a bird thinking about humans, it's thoughtful, fun, evocative, and moving. The poems challenge our emotions, and it's an experience that makes reading this book uncomfortable in places, but throughout deeply personal. Lorna Crozier has won many awards for her books of poetry and prose. She's been on the past for her books, The Book of Marvels, A Compendium of Everyday Things, and her memoir, The Terrific Small Beneath the Sky. She is a professor emerita at the University of Victoria, an officer of the Order of Canada, and the recipient of 3 honorary doctorates. The website for more is at lornacrozier.ca. The book is published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program in Victoria today, Lorna Crozier. Ms. Crozier, good morning.
Hi, I'm really glad to be back with you.
Nice to talk to you again as well. This collection, The Wrong Cat, the poems therein, what do you think they represent?
Oh, wow. That's a really big question. I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I guess they represent my feelings, my ideas, my concerns, my whimsicalities, my sorrows at this stage in my life, which is really the last 3 years or so, or maybe 5 years in this case, because you mentioned the prose poem book I did called The Book of Marvels, and I was also writing lineated poems during that time, and some of them have made their way into this book. So it's sort of 5 years of a poet's life got included in the covers of this book.
Yeah, and I guess these are 5 years, I mean, they're 5 eventful years in your life as well, is that right?
I guess they always are.
Our years are, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah. One of the most eventful things is that I left the university 2 years ago, mm-hmm. And that's always a huge move when you leave a profession, a job that you've been passionately engaged with for over 20 years. And I was very worried about that because I have had some wonderful students, and I worried that I would miss people of that age in my life because I wasn't allowed to get dusty because I kept meeting these 18, 19, 20-year-olds with a passion for poetry, and I had to keep up with them. So I had some concerns about that, but I found these last 2 years to be as rich as the years when I was teaching and more crammed in some ways than before.
So you found more time to write poetry in these last couple of years, say?
Yeah, more time to write poetry, but also more time to say yes to invitations that were coming my way. So I've been on the road a lot, and I'm a little weary. I've been doing a lot of workshops and a lot of, you know, keynote speeches and things like that, traveling around the country. So it's been fun, but a little wearying at the same time. My husband, Patrick Lane, wrote a wonderful poem called The Ecstasy of No. And it comes from him saying that to me one day, you have to learn the ecstasy of no. And I said, write that down. And he did and created a poem around that idea. And one of the lines in the poem is, his wife is going off to the airport, comma, brightly. And I think that refers to me.
How is Patrick, by the way?
He's doing great.
Yeah.
He's doing a lot of gardening because I'm busy once again preparing for a workshop that I'm going to give outside of Kingston starting on Sunday. So I've been imprisoning myself in the house, working on what I want to talk about poetry.
Yeah, I've had him on a couple of times, and they're always favorite conversations, as are the ones that I've had with you over the years.
That's a great show. Thank you.
The last time he was on, he was talking about, I guess you have a tree across the street in the park there that you're taking the ivy off of.
Yeah, we've almost cleared the whole little forest.
Mm-hmm.
It's just been a wonderful thing that he has gotten us engaged in. And ivy, of course, ends up killing trees, and there are these giant fir and spruce and cedar and some gary oak and maples, and we've been going out with our secateurs and chopping through the ivy. And I don't think I've ever done anything that quite pleases me as much as doing that. I kind of feel that the tree is giving me a hug afterwards, saying, you know, thanks so much for freeing me. I can breathe again, and it's a great sense of accomplishment. You know, because we always worry, what can we do? And right. In this world that humans are so rapidly destroying, is there any small act that we can do to make the world a better place and retain the beauty that's there? And this is one small thing that Patrick and I have been able to do.
And throughout this collection, The Wrong Cat, there is this deep reverence that you have for the world outside. So it's your surroundings, it's the animals, the birds, and so on, that are around you. They say of poets that they notice the world a little differently. Is that part of noticing the world differently, do you think, that you have this appreciation, this, I would say, understanding of, say, the other creatures around us?
Yeah, I don't know if poets observe the world differently, but I think that to be a poet, you have to be, your senses have to be on hyper alert. You have to bring in attentiveness to the everyday things that sometimes when you're not in a poetic mood, you miss yourself. You know, the beauty of the yellow irises in our pond right now is almost a kind of a startling pain. They're so gorgeous in the sunshine this morning. And I can walk by them and not see them if I don't get myself into the state of remembering that I have a very, very short time on the earth, in this world, even if I'm lucky enough to live into my 70s or 80s. It's not long enough, so I better pay attention while I'm here. And what poets do, I think, is try to keep their senses engaged, to send antennae out into the world, but then to take that other step, and that is to try to find language that can come somewhere close to containing that beauty or sorrow or exquisiteness that is touching our skins and filling our nostrils and our ears all the time.
Is committing poetry, is writing poetry, is that difficult? I mean, do you find, let's say your senses are attuned, finding the language to commit poetry, do you think that that's, I mean, does it come easy for you, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask?
Some days it does. Mm-hmm. Some poems come as small resonant gifts, but others take a lot of just trying to refine what it is I'm trying to get at. I mean, our language is so stained and so abused. It's so full of cliches and huge abstractions, and I really feel it's the task in the poem to dig through all of that and to make the old words shine again somehow. And that's a real challenge. You know, how do you use the word love in a poem anymore? How do you make it sound new? How do you bring all your personality to a word that's been so battered about and so covered with dust and so abused? And so that's a challenge, and that's never easy. You know, Robert Frost once said, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. And I'm always looking for those movements in language, those combinations of words that surprise me, and then I hope that I've done something that will surprise someone else.
So there can be a long period of time from, say, starting a poem and finishing one for you?
Yeah, sometimes the poem is done within a day or two. Other mm-hmm. poems need to sit around for 3 years or more. And I go and I visit them. I knock on the door and ask if I can drop in and look at them and talk to them for a while. And I, you know, try to enter the poem space, the space again, and diddle around with the lines and think about the sound and the music and find what I'm pleased with and what I'm not pleased with anymore, and keep trying to make it a more beautiful, more luminous thing.
And so poems for you can be pieces that pieces of wisdom that you've learned over, I don't know, the last few years, over say, a period of time, whatever you're writing about. When you write, do you find that you're trying to work something through? I mean, let's say you're going through something like a difficult period in time. Have you found solace in writing poetry?
The solace is in the act of writing itself. You know, it is in the making of something. But I don't think it's that comforting for the writer ultimately to write about a death, for instance. I think you still feel as much grief at the end of the poem as you did at the beginning. But what you feel is some kind of joy in having created something new. I hope that makes sense. I used to think that art healed, but I've come to believe that art doesn't heal the artist, doesn't heal the writer, but maybe it's a small step towards helping someone else who encounters the painting or the photograph or the poem, but the artist just keeps bumbling and stumbling on and trying to do it better next time, never resting on any kind of laurels. And I think when writing a poem that whatever small wisdom I have comes from finding the metaphors that are already there, but just kind of discovering them anew again, how all things are related. And when that connection happens in language on my page, I'm always startled by it, as if I've stumbled upon some kind of truth that I subconsciously perhaps knew but didn't consciously before. So the metaphor, I think, leads us to a kind of wisdom and a connection of my inwardness with the world's outwardness, and where they come together, there's sort of a spark. But it's not me having an absolute knowing about anything, because I don't think I know very much.
So you do gain wisdom from, say, reading poetry?
Definitely. Yeah. Reading someone else's poetry, for sure.
Yeah, and does that, it obviously makes you a better poet, I suppose, doesn't it?
Reading someone else's mm-hmm. work and gaining wisdom? Oh, most definitely. Yeah. I've often said to my students that they didn't need to study writing at university, that they just had to read, and read with the eye of a writer, not only absorbing what it is we can learn from those great writers that have come before us and are writing during our time as well, but also the way, the strategies they use, you know, the way they open a poem, the way they close a poem, how they make those wonderful leaps within the body of the poem itself, that you can learn all that just by being a very avid reader.
For you, does poetry ask as many questions as it answers? I mean, probably
more. Yeah.
Yeah.
More. I don't think it answers any questions, really.
For you, I mean,
Rilke has that wonderful line that we must learn to live the questions and, you know, live them in a way that has never been done before. And I am definitely, that's a piece of wisdom from him that I've held close to my heart, that if I thought I was giving anybody answers, I wouldn't write. I would clam up. So I hope what I'm doing is presenting the brief moments of rare beauty, rare feeling in one's life, and opening up a whole new list of what those questions are.
And if you didn't get those poems out of you, what do you think that'd do to you? I'd probably confound you and frustrate you, probably.
Yeah, most definitely. I can get frustrated when a poem's not working, but I'd be much more frustrated if I weren't writing, I think. It's a way, you know, there's a Chinese saying that writing poetry is like being alive twice. And I love that idea that you, you know, I experience, let's say, a love for one of my cats, but when I then try to express that in a poem, that love comes alive at least a second time, and then a time again when perhaps a reader runs into it. So when you're paying attention, you're living fully in the moment, but you get to expand that moment and somehow maybe even capture it in the hourglass of poetry, and you're able to look at it again and re-experience it again.
Are you able to write throughout the day, or are there certain times when you do write?
It's just when something grabs a hold of me and makes me think that I should try to find a way to say what it is I'm feeling or thinking or you know, experiencing. It can happen any time, but usually sort of mid-morning until early afternoon are probably my best times for writing.
In the book, you write about animals a few times. When you write about, say, a bird, as you do in the book, what the bird might be thinking about us humans, I get the sense that you've understood that animal a little differently than most people, perhaps understood it better.
I hope so, Joe. You're talking about the crow one,
yeah.
For instance, where the crow speaks about human beings. I'm feeling, you know, like most humans in this early part of this new century, a lot of despair about our relationships with our fellow creatures and the egomaniacal nature of the human that thinks that we can destroy any habitat and get away with it for the sake of greed, really, for owning more things and producing more things in the world. And so I'm heartbroken. And my way, I guess, of dealing with that heartbreak is to try to honor the animals and write praise poems for them, really, in that kind of superstitious way that poetry knows that maybe if I write about it, I am somehow protecting them, or I'm making people say, hey, wait a minute, this creature is as valuable as I am, and it has sensations, and it has a mind, and it can fly, and I can't, and maybe I should think about that a little bit.
See, I have a rather hostile relationship towards crows, because when I was a kid, walking through the neighbors, I guess it was this time of year, I don't know if it's mating season or if they've just hatched, but around this time of year in May, I was walking down the street, and this crow followed me for about a block, you know, swooping down from say the going from the tree to the houses and just following me, and it just frightened me.
Did it attack you? Did
no,
it hit your head with its claws?
It tried to.
And yeah, so, I've had that happen. That's usually they're protecting their young, and they want you to stay away from where their nests are.
Yeah,
but
so,
don't forget, my name is Crozier. I've got a crow in my name.
There you go. So I guess,
and, I mean, yeah. They're just such smart. They're just such smart birds. They're certainly not gentle, and they have some very bad habits. But so do I. Maybe you weren't paying enough attention to it, you know.
That's probably it. Yeah. In reading your poem, I got the sense that you have a great deal of empathy towards crows that I probably don't have.
Well, I hope the poem will change you then. You see,
yeah.
Maybe the poem will make a difference. That's what every poet hopes for, whether it happens or not. But no, I think crows are just fascinating creatures. The fact that they know how to use tools. You know, the fact that they grieve for their dead, that they flock together and just hang around for the fun of it. They obviously have great conversations, and I wish we could understand what they're saying.
Yeah, they seem a lot smarter than, say, other birds that we might see, like pigeons or even seagulls. I mean, seagulls seem resourceful more than anything.
And seagulls have been terribly sentimentalized in Jonathan Livingston's Seagull. Remember that book?
Mm-hmm.
So they might be harder to write about from an anthropomorphic point of view. I don't know. But and there are great poems about crows, of course, from the past. I'm thinking of Ted Hughes' book, Crow, where he says that he used the most pared-down, hard, almost ugly language that he could use to write a poem, because of the subject matter, and it gave those poems a real edge that he didn't have in the work prior to that.
Yeah, we always think that owls are wise, but I tend to think that crows are a little smarter.
Yeah, and they definitely have a sense of humor, I think.
Yeah. You mentioned having cats, so you guys are obviously cat people, is that right?
Yeah, I don't think you have to be a cat person or a dog person. I think you can be both.
Hmm.
But right now in our lives, we have two cats.
And you know, we hear those cliches of you know, that the cat owns you, or you know, you don't own the cat, that you know, the cat's picked you, I guess, or whatever, to live with you. I mean, are those things, do those things ring true for you?
most definitely. Yeah, the cats boss us around completely. They let us know when they want to be fed and when they want out, We have a TV in the back room, and when one of our cats wants to sit on our lap in that room, he comes and herds me down there to sit in the chair with my feet out so he can sit and purr. If I don't come, he yowls and pulls me from my desk with great annoyance because he won't let me think. So, yeah, they're in charge around here, and it's one of the things I love about them is although cats are domesticated, their domesticity is just a very thin veil over this very feral creature that cares for you. I think they're affectionate, but it's also independent at the same time.
Yeah, I know people who own cats, and it's a very, I don't say peculiar, but it's a unique relationship that they have that other people who own other animals don't have with.
See, you've already used the wrong verb. You don't own a cat.
No,
you don't own a cat.
There you go. See,
it owns you.
Yeah. See, I've never had a pet, so this is all.
Oh no! Look what you're missing. Yeah, and cats definitely did embed their way into my new book. You know, I'd had that sequence about five little cat poems around for a while, wondering what to do to them, and it seemed to be a good use of them to have them introduce the different sections of the book.
Yeah, and when you put this collection together, I guess you do put a lot of thought into how the poems are grouped and what the poems' subjects are that are in the book, I guess. I mean, you talk about animals, you talk about conversations that people have with one another as well.
Mm-hmm. I had a lot of trouble organizing this book before the manuscript stage, when I just had this big pack of loose pages of poetry, and I thought it was time and I had enough work to pull something together. But I didn't have a book in my head. I just had individual poems. So I actually hired a freelance editor who doesn't do any line-by-line stuff, but just helps you try to find the shape of what you've got. Because my big worry was I have these poems, the ones that you already mentioned about animals and cats and crows and so on, and then there are a series of poems in the third person, which seem to me to be kind of mini novels, where there are characters and there's a plot, and a man and a woman are having a conflict and talking to each other, and they have a much longer line, and they feel kind of like small novels to me. And I thought, how am I going to put all of these together, or are they different books and I just have to write more of one to make it, you know, an integrated kind of thing? But this fellow that helped me see the shape did the thing that I've done all my life, and that is split the manuscript into sections. That always helps. But then scatter those different kinds of poems together in different sections, and the manuscript started to cohere. But I really needed an outside eye to help me see the order in the midst of the chaos of those 5 years of writing.
So those poems about, say, where you have these characters, these people talking to one another, the sense that I got that these were discussions or these were happenings that were taking place at the end of the day, say.
A couple of them are taking place in bed.
And yeah. It's sort of at the time just before sleep, just before rest.
Right,
And
where sometimes the tough questions get asked or the tough things get said.
Yeah, and they seem like conversations that we all recognize.
Yeah, I hope so. I think all of those came from, you know, a real feeling or a true statement or occurrence. But then I fictionalized, you know, and pushed things beyond autobiography and into that other place we call fiction. And I think fiction takes place even within poetry, although within poetry we often think that I is the poet. It's often a fictional I as well as a lyrical one.
And so was there something that you wanted to evoke in terms of this period at the end of the day, say?
I think I just wanted to evoke the feeling of, you know, a man and a woman who've been together for quite a while, and there are the irritations that occur and the questions and the insecurities remain even in a long relationship. And I just wanted to get that kind of mood and tone of you know, the two of them are together, and oh no, we're going to have another quibble, and what's it going to be about this time, and is our marriage over, and things can end so unexpectedly without one member of the couple even knowing that the other one has fallen out of love. And I guess I wanted to create those moments of possible pressure and surprise that sometimes we forget can happen.
Yeah, there's one poem where they're discussing something, and then and it ends with her, you know, putting the cold cream on her face.
Yeah.
And you think to yourself, well, how does it end? But then you know how it ends, because some people have been through conversations like that over the years.
Yeah, exactly. And the last thing I want to do is for the poem to snap shut at the end, to click shut.
Yeah.
I'd like the, I hope my endings, and I really try to make this happen, open up and make you go back into the poem and take another look at it rather than say, okay, now we're going to sum everything up, and here's the moral, here's the message, and now you can close the book and go to sleep. I want it to be the opposite. You said some of the poems make you feel uncomfortable, and I hope sometimes that's why, because you're left still walking the tightrope. You know, you haven't fallen off into a net. Nothing's caught you at the end of the poem. You have to stay on that tightrope a little while longer.
So you obviously reread poetry. Do you reread your own poetry and find things on a subsequent reading that you didn't know, say, when you were writing it?
Yeah, all the time, Joe. It's what makes the poems still interesting. I think if it's a bad poem, if it's a poorly written poem or a shallow poem, that doesn't happen, and those are the ones that hopefully I don't let go into print, that I put into my discard pile. But if the poem continues to interest me for one reason or another, then I hope I've stumbled upon something of value.
I understand that you're working with Ian McAllister in a project, is that right?
Yeah, I'm so excited about this. Ian sent me a number of photographs about a year and a half ago now. We had met in the Great Bear Rainforest, and a mutual friend suggested we might like to work together, and I just said, well, no, that's not going to happen, you know, because this is not my place. And Ian has been there for over 25 years, and I was just passing through, but we chatted about the possibility, and then he said, well, why don't I send you something, and we'll see what happens. So he sent me some of these amazing photographs he's taken. These were all new ones since his last book, which just came out in the fall, and they did spark inside of me, and I ended up writing around 35 poems or so that were inspired by his photographs. And of course, the challenge for me was that his photographs don't need any explication, they don't need any description, so I had to find a way to write something that conversed with his photographs, that rubbed against them, but that didn't explicate in any way. They're not captions, they're their own thing, but the photographs, of course, enhance what I've written, and hopefully vice versa. So we have a book, and it's coming out this fall with Greystone.
The you said you went up there to the Great Bear Rainforest. If you hadn't gone there and you only looked at these photographs, did you think you would have had the same sort of output in terms of the poetry that you've written?
No, not at all. I'm the kind of person who needs to have my feet firmly in a place, and I have to be able to hear the place and smell the place as well as see it, and certainly see it through my own eyes rather than just through the artistic eyes of even someone as talented as Ian. So I definitely had to be there, and I had to stand out in the rain for hours waiting to see a bear. And sometimes that worked and sometimes it didn't, but standing in the rainforest and my whole body sensing what that meant, what that place might be, was absolutely essential to my writing of the poems.
Yeah, you know, we forget sometimes because we're busy with life, most of us are, that just what a great place we live in. I mean, where you live in Victoria there, where I live in Vancouver, where, you know, if you go up the coast, say, an hour or two, it's a whole different world, and it's where we live, isn't it?
We have the wilderness all around us still, and for most people, wilderness is just a fancy name they read in a book. you know, and they have no idea that there are places where you can go where you can be in real danger. You know, you can get lost easily in the trees. You can drown in the ocean. You can meet a bear in the wrong place in the wrong time, and maybe not escape from that encounter. And that's part of, as you say, living here. It makes it really difficult to travel anywhere else because we live in the heart of such beauty that it's overwhelming sometimes.
Yeah, I told you before we started that I took your book, The Wrong Cat, with me on vacation.
Yeah.
And so I went to New York, and reading the book as I did, you know, on planes or trains or whatever, reminded me of this place and how much I missed it, I guess. I mean, I was only away for a week or so, but I mean, I missed it. I missed this place.
Oh, that pleases me greatly that the book brought your home place back to you.
Yeah, it was a great companion, I must say.
Good.
Yeah, it's always fun to talk, Lorna, and read your work. All the best to you and Patrick. Thanks for this.
I really appreciate your interest. It means a lot to me.
You're very welcome. The website from our LornaCrozier.ca. The book is called The Wrong Cat. It's from McClelland and Stewart. Do pick it up. You'll get something out of it, whether you're looking for it or not. It's author Lorna Crozier. Join me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.